Hey, I'm Samuel Sagan. This is the second talk of this series entitled Teacher vs. Guru. Here, I'll go into the guru system in more detail. First, one thing I want to make very clear is that I do not think there is something wrong with the guru system. Sincere disciples, including Westerners, can have massive spiritual shifts when working with a guru. The method of a school such as the Clairvision School is very different. But that doesn't mean that we can't respect other systems and appreciate their value. So let's not fall into clichés here. Why is it, by the way, that gurus have come to have somewhat of a bad name in the West? It's a fact. The term guru often conjures up negative associations. Why is this? It may well have to do with the fact that the people who first brought Indian gurus to the West in the 1960s lacked the kind of historical and cultural context that I laid out in the first talk. They tried to forge a social context, meaning create a cultural definition for a guru in the Western world. Things might have turned out quite differently. The truth is, Western disciples were, and often still are, badly unprepared to work with a guru. This, actually, would be an important piece of advice I would give to someone who's about to engage in a guru-disciple relationship. Don't try to work with a guru as if the guru were just like a teacher in the Western meaning of the term. No one forces you to work with a guru, but if you do, you must understand how the system works. Unless you can mold yourself on that very particular modus operandi, you'll only go from disappointment to disappointment. Let me give you a few examples. First-hand observations made during the years when I was living between France and India, and often serving as a translator for Indian and Tibetan teachers. As a Westerner, when I say something, I normally mean it. I regard my words as something that must be carefully crafted to convey as precise a meaning as possible. But this is not quite the way the traditional Indian mind operates. In particular, when a guru speaks, what matters isn't so much the words that are said, but more the space that is being created and the effect it will have on those who listen. Here's something I've observed when being a translator in teaching sessions or interviews between Westerners and Indian gurus. Westerners would ask a precise question with direct implications for their personal life. The guru would give an answer that was intended to be taken in a very general and unspecific way, listening to it from the standpoint of the traditional Indian mind. That was obvious. But coming from a much more rational Western standpoint, the disciples would take in the letter of what was said, rather than the spirit of the moment. On a few occasions, I have seen this be responsible for major life mistakes. Disciples going home with what they believe to be clear instructions from their guru and perhaps selling their business or taking other hasty decisions that later on proved catastrophic. When learning about it, the guru himself was the first to be appalled. There, really, cultural discrepancies can take a toll. So never forget this if you want to work with an Indian guru. You must get the big picture. Do not listen to the guru as if he were a Western scuba diving instructor whose instructions are purely factual and designed to be taken literally. They said some instructions given by the guru are indeed designed to be followed very precisely, but others are to be understood symbolically, not literally. How do you know which is which? Ah, there's not necessarily a magic formula here. When working with a guru, you often wish there was one. What's for sure is that the more familiar you become with the general modus operandi of your guru, and perhaps even more importantly, with the Indian cultural background at large, the more likely you are to harmonize yourself with the flow of teaching, rather than taking things completely out of context. For example, here's something to ponder on. At the heart of the guru's teaching modus operandi is an age-old tradition of India and Tibet that can be summarized by the words divine madness. Divine madness, it can have massive punch and project you into intense states of consciousness, mind-boggling realizations. At the same time, you'd better be prepared. For disciples, Divine madness is in many ways the spiritual teaching equivalent of a meat grinder. Let me give you a few examples. Around 1983, I had the privilege to meet a great saint in India, one of the most powerful gurus I've ever encountered. His name was Hirakan Vishwamahadam. Funnily enough, when preparing this talk, I tried typing Hirakan Vishwamahadam in a search engine, to which, with surprising insight, the search engine replied, "Did you mean Hurricane Vishwamahadam?" "Precisely, a hurricane. This is exactly what this man was. I have never seen such solid gold in someone's aura. It extended meters around him. And his place, his ashram, surrounded by the magic of the Himalayas, was completely unreal. It took me days traveling through the Himalayas by train and bus to get there. The last miles of the journey had to be done on foot, crossing the Gotama Ganga River several times while carrying my bags over my head. Yes, I do mean this. No bridges, crossing the river with my bags, passport and all those things, above my head. Despite the isolation, there were about 100 people there. Some very impressive yogis and seekers, including a number of Westerners, people of great maturity, their eyes beaming with light. These people were not just seekers, they were finders. They had dimension. They were genuine. They impressed me enormously. What was the latest news at the ashram? Well, someone had brought a large bell from Switzerland and presented it to Hirakan, kind of bell Swiss cows wear. And Hirakan had ordered his oldest disciple to walk around the ashram wearing the bell around his neck. And also, from now on in the ashrams, the Italians were to wear only black shirts, so as to prepare for the Great Revolution. So had Hirakan decreed. Believe me, in the crazy holiness of this Himalayan spiritual cauldron and among high-caliber, long-trained seekers and yogis, it passed fine, as if you could read the cosmic logic behind every instruction. I couldn't avoid wondering, though, what if a British tabloid caught hold of these stories? Or what if the ashram had been located in a suburb of Los Angeles instead of a remote corner of the Himalayas? See what I mean when I say that a context is required? Before even trying to grasp what the tradition of divine madness is about, one must first ponder on the topic of deconstruction. Deconstruction is one of the most essential concepts to understand if you are to understand the spiritual path. Whether with an Indian guru or Western teacher, Indian methods of deconstruction tend to be quite different from Western ones. Still, whatever path you follow, there'll be no decisive progress without deconstruction. Deconstruction refers to the undoing of a world of preconceptions, reality-distorting effects, false assumptions, emotional baggage, and pre-programmed behavior that people carry, and which act as a thick screen blocking higher states of consciousness. The crap in your mind. Layers and layers of it. According to esoteric models, it has accumulated over lifetimes. A genuine spiritual path, therefore, must include two dimensions: construction and deconstruction. In the construction category, you would place the acquisition of knowledge and techniques of meditation that build states of higher awareness, or energetic processes aimed at developing your chi, and so on. In the deconstruction category, you would place psychological processes aimed at stripping entire parts of yourself, the psychological equivalent of losing weight, toward original spontaneity, very much as in Yi Jing Hexagram 24, the return, symbolizing a return to a primordial, non-corrupt state. A guru, therefore, sees it as an essential part of his function to deconstruct his disciples' grasping mind, meaning the part of the mind that constantly tries to hold on, rather than letting go and opening to the flow of higher states of consciousness. There, it's easy to see how divine madness fits in the picture. Indian gurus can have this way of adding a touch of madness to the world around them. This, if properly received, can bring about great openings among the disciples. In India, it is expected. It is part of a long and prestigious tradition of Lila, or cosmic game, so beautifully presented in Sanskrit texts. Let me give you an example of deconstruction in action, Indian style. Here, I won't mention names. Once in Paris, I served as a translator from English to French for an old Indian teacher who, with his orange dhotis and his long grey beard, was the very image of a classical guru. During previous trips to Paris, the guru had used a certain professor who taught psychology in a university as his translator and lecture organizer. The professor was quite protective of his relationship with the guru. As you can imagine, disciples tend to invest a huge amount of emotional energy in their relationship with the guru. So the professor was quite unhappy that the guru had now requested me as his new translator. So that day, I happened to be in the company of the guru in the professor's apartment. The guru was resting on a bed. I was sitting by his side on a chair. There was only one chair in the room. The professor was out. Then someone announced that the professor was back. The guru turned to me and said, "Leave him the chair." So I moved off the chair and sat on the floor. But the guru said, "No, no, sit on the bed, by my side." I remember thinking, "Oh no, I could see where this was headed." "Put your hand on my knee," the guru said. And as I did so, he put his hand on my hand and started gazing at me as if I were his beloved son, his beloved daughter, and his favorite disciple all at once. Gurus are very good at that. You can imagine what happened 30 seconds later when the professor entered the room. He became green, not just with jealousy, but with sheer rage. It was a major reaction, ugliness oozing out of him. He stayed silent, speechless. He was nearly shaking. One thing you have to admire about gurus is that they have a knack for pressing people's buttons. This is, of course, facilitated by the immensely charged emotions that people project onto them. After all, the guru is supposed to be divine. Still, they are masters in the art, and the deconstruction games, or lila, aren't just uncannily precise and well-targeted. They are relentless. They go on and on and on, to the point, ideally, where all resistance mechanisms in the disciple become exhausted, and major openings can take place. Let me tell you another story about divine madness, this one, I believe, coming from the Tibetan tradition. A Tibetan ascetic was meditating in a large hut that had been made available to him by a sponsor. The sponsor also gave the man a small sum of money every month, so he could feed himself while engaged in his meditation pursuits. One day, it's announced that the sponsor is coming to visit, so the man starts tidying up and cleaning the hut, the kind of things people do to make a good impression, until he realizes, from high, "What am I doing? My goal is to reach the unconditioned state of consciousness, and here I am, bound by the most trivial social conventions." And, moved from high, he starts turning the room into complete chaos, throwing furniture around and smearing the wall with ashes from the stove. Soon after, the sponsor arrives. Seeing the mess, he's stunned. The two men look at each other and, the story says, they have a profound opening. One of those immensely precious experiences where all logic is transcended. The veil is rent. Consciousness gets in touch with its own infinity. That's what deconstruction is about. Deconstruction grand style, as in the tradition of divine madness. Problem is, openings don't often happen as quickly as in the story. With Westerners in particular, the layers that require deconstruction are thick. Besides, Westerners, when they begin their quest, often lack the context and the quality of opening required to properly handle the deconstruction games played on them by the guru. back to that apartment in Paris, with the old guru lying on the bed and lovingly holding my hand, looking at me intensely and barely turning his head when the professor entered the room. The guru had laid a space in that room. Had the professor been able to open, the three of us could just have burst out laughing, and a great opening would have ensued, just as in the story of the Tibetan ascetic and his sponsor. But this is not what happened. The professor was not ready. For a start, his emotional baggage was far too entrenched for such a letting go to be possible. But, even more importantly, he had no understanding that this game had everything to do with helping him to deconstruct, and nothing to do with some special friendship between the guru and I. So the professor just became a little more closed, and also, predictably, he started hating my guts. Let's stop and ponder again on context here. If you go and work with a guru, it's likely no one will warn you about deconstruction. Yet be assured of one thing, it's coming. And when it arrives, it's likely to be brutal. Why isn't anyone warning you? Why isn't there an instruction notice at the door of the ashram? Because this spiritual modus operandi has been part of the Indian spiritual tradition for centuries. It is embedded in the meme of Indian spirituality. Meme being a very useful term to describe corporate cultures and collective behavior patterns in the broadest possible meaning. Brief digression on memes. A meme is an atmosphere of consciousness that conveys know-how. Know-how about the way to behave, to speak, to think, to dress, and so on. In the meme of a modern corporation, for example, secretaries don't have to be taught how to behave as secretaries. And managers don't have to be told how to behave as managers. Behaviors fall into place by themselves due to all the cultural associations and mechanisms that form the very fabric of a meme. Similarly, in the Indian spiritual meme, the lila of deconstruction falls into place naturally. It's as if, to open, disciples only had to follow a pre-existing groove. Deconstruction, though, is never easy, since it's about undoing the most hardened parts of an individual. In my book, Regression, Past Life Therapy for Here and Now Freedom, you'll find the story of Marpa and Milarepa, a famous guru-disciple pair of the Tibetan tradition, and how Marpa drove Milarepa to the edge of insanity by asking him to build and rebuild and rebuild again and again an entire stone house. Can this model be transposed to Westerners, though? Yes and no. If you want to become the disciple of a guru, and if you have sufficient integrity and determination, then my answer is definitely yes. No matter where you were born, you can make it work with your guru. But for this, you need to forget about Western values. You'll have to immerse yourself into the meme of Indian spirituality and, open from the depths of yourself, surrender and let go unrestrictedly. Persist, 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 and all resistances will end up fading. Let me insist on the question of opening and surrender. It tells a lot about the differences between Eastern and Western modes of spiritual teaching. Deconstruction may not be a Sanskrit word, but the way of making the most of a disciple-guru relationship is well mapped in the Indian tradition. What is the disciple supposed to do? Open. Surrender. This would be very traditional advice that people in an ashram give to newcomers, and that can also be found in Sanskrit texts. Surrender to the guru. What does surrender entail? Letting go of any form of resistance. Letting go of your mind. Letting go of everything. Let the light and presence of the guru come to you. Here's a famous story from the Mahabharata, the story of Ekalavya. In the Mahabharata, Arjuna is being trained by his guru Drona to become a super warrior, the greatest archer of his time. One day, as Arjuna and the rest of the Pandava brothers are practicing in the forest with Drona, they come across a barking dog. Before the brothers have time to even raise their weapons, the dog is shot by someone else, 7 arrows straight into its open mouth, so fast that the dog did not even have time to close his mouth. Drona is amazed. Who could be capable of such a feat? The archer turns out to be Ekalavya, a boy whose dream was to study under the great Drona, but who could never have been accepted as a disciple by Drona, because he didn't have the required social status. Ekalavya was from a low caste, not from the warrior's caste. So what did Ekalavya do? He built a clay statue of Drona, and he started worshipping it. Ekalavya was so sincere, his devotion and surrender to Drona were so complete, that all of Drona's knowledge and art started flowing into him. So, without even physically working with Drona, Ekalavya became a supremely accomplished archer. There you go, the whole guru system of spiritual transmission summarized in one story. This story didn't end well, by the way. Drona called Ekalavya and said, "Since I taught you, now is the time for me to request my wages." That's a classic element in the Indian tradition. Having taught someone, a guru then asks for a favor or wages, and the disciple simply cannot refuse, no matter what is being asked. So Drona asks for Ekalavya's thumb. The boy immediately obliged and cut off his own thumb, which of course marked the end of his career as an archer. Digression. Was Drona being cruel? To be fair, the point is still debated as of today. A view is that Drona was very wise. He saw a great war coming, the war of the Mahabharata, and he knew that preserving the order of the world required that Arjuna be the greatest archer of his time. Rather than being sentimental, Drona chose the line of highest good for the world and sacrificed Ekalavya. Back to our discussion of the guru method. With Ekalavya's story, we are touching on something essential about the guru-disciple modus operandi of spiritual transmission. The disciple must model himself on the guru. The disciple must erase his own personality, as suggested by the deeply symbolic act of pranam, or prostration, and let himself be flooded by the guru's presence and grace. Let the guru in. By the way, one thing that can be amazing when visiting Indian ashrams is how disciples can end up resembling their guru. It's not always like this, of course. Remember, India is a big world. Still, an example that struck me was that of Swami Satyananda Saraswati, whose ashram was in Mongir in the state of Bihar, and who was a disciple of Swami Shivananda of Rishikesh. Satyananda was a small, thin man. Shivananda was a tall and broad-shouldered fellow, and had the kind of serious belly a guru can be expected to have in the spiritual meme of India. Look at photographs of Swami Satyananda Saraswati before his enlightenment, a small, thin man. Then look at a picture of Satyananda after his enlightenment. It's as if he had doubled in size and now strangely started resembling Shivananda. And that was not a unique case. In ashrams, it's quite common for disciples to speak like their guru, model the guru in every possible way, and even start looking like the guru after a while. Again, remember that the Indian spiritual universe is vast. You could no doubt find many examples where this didn't apply. Still, what's implied by the Indian model is that all forms of personality are pure illusion. The guru is a fire, which the disciples embrace to burn anything inside themselves that can be burned, including any form of personality or individuality. Hence the Guru Gita sings, always remembering the Guru's form, always repeating the mantra given by the Guru, think of nothing other than the Guru. Let's stop and ponder here. We're at the very essence of the Guru method, and we're also touching on crucial differences between Eastern and Western methods of spiritual transmission. A teacher, in the Western meaning of the term, points to a spiritual direction, whereas the guru is the spiritual direction. The teacher shows the way, the guru is the way. Working with a teacher, you learn to establish your own relationship to the divine, your own line of spiritual connection, whereas the guru is the line of connection. Now, don't be fooled. If you go to an introductory lecture given by a guru, you are unlikely to hear this sort of language. And you can of course study for years in the company of a guru, learn many marvelous things and make discoveries about yourself, without having to commit to this point of surrender to the guru. Ashrams are full of tourists. People who have neither the qualities, nor even the intent to make the techniques work and reach high states of enlightenment. If, however, you really want to push things and reach the kind of states that the guru himself or herself experiences, then you must embrace the whole method, the traditional modus operandi of transmission, as it has worked in India for many centuries. In a spiritual path, east or west, choosing the bits you like and leaving out the bits you don't like is never an option. I started this part of the discussion asking whether the guru system was transposable to Westerners, and my answer was yes and no. Yes, because I don't see any reason why Westerners wouldn't be capable of embracing the Indian spiritual meme and pushing the guru-disciple form of transmission to its limit with the corresponding high states of consciousness. I have seen Westerners successfully do this, by the way. After all, it's just a method. Why couldn't you apply it? Compared to the immense challenge of reaching high states of consciousness, having to adapt to different cultural rules is altogether not such a big deal. However, a completely different question would be, can you take the whole guru-disciple system, as in a large Indian ashram, and successfully transpose it into the Western world? Let me return to the legendary story of Marpa and Milarepa, a story that has inspired so many generations of spiritual seekers. How would it transpose into the Western world? Say, Marpa has just opened an ashram in the hills north of Los Angeles. A group of enthusiastic would-be disciples have just joined the ashram, but just by taking a look at them, Marpa can tell they are not yet ready for any in-depth spiritual practice. Some serious deconstruction is going to be needed. So, following the most traditional methods, Marpa instructs the group to build a meditation hall made of stone on the grounds of the ashram, and he leaves them working on the construction site. Funds collected from disciples will finance the project. 2 months later, Marpa returns to the site and immediately declares, "This building shape is never going to work for the tantric practices I teach. I'm sorry, but the building must be pulled down. Anyway, the location wasn't right. Let's put the building over there," Marpa orders, pointing to the opposite side of the property. So the builders pull down the walls and transport the stones to the other side of the property. And this time, to match the tantric flavor of Marpa's teaching, they erect a triangular building. 2 months later, when Marpa returns, he becomes enraged. He yells at them, "How dare you build a triangular building for me to teach in? Are you implying that I am some sort of filthy sorcerer? A black magician, perhaps? Pull down this building immediately. I want a circular hall." And Marpa goes from disciple to disciple, making sure each one is sufficiently yelled at. Being yelled at by a spiritual teacher, by the way, is nothing like being abused by a normal person. It comes with a devastating punch. And because the timing and the calibration are so precise, it shakes you to the core. It often triggers major emotional chain reactions. Anyway, 2 months later, Marpa returns to the building site. This time, he is very calm and composed. He exclaims, "Oh, what a beautiful building! A perfect shape to create meditation spaces. But I wonder, why have we put it here? It's a terrible location, really." By that time, it's likely 2/3 of the disciples have already left, and the remaining contingent is deeply demoralized. Besides, these nonsensical operations have left the association's finances in tatters. One of the disciples points out, "But Marpa, you told us to put the building here." To which Marpa replies, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I must have been drunk on that day. But now I can see clearly. The site is wrong. This building must be moved." If you think I'm being facetious, just take a look at the original Tibetan story. I'm actually sticking to the script quite closely. The original story goes on and on, taking Milarepa to the edge of insanity, pushing him to contemplate suicide more than once. Now, just imagine newspapers catching hold of a story like this. How do you think they'd make it look? And how long would it be before someone in that organization started a lawsuit? We live in a world where people sue each other for a whole lot less than this. No wonder gurus have had a problem of image in the Western world. Incidentally, bad press and lawsuits are exactly what happened around Bhagwan Rajneesh after he attempted to relocate from India to the US. Was there something wrong with Rajneesh? As far as I'm concerned, absolutely not. In any case, certainly not according to the criteria that define the guru-disciple mode of transmission and the age-old tradition of divine madness, which Rajneesh demonstrated sublimely and relentlessly. What we have here is a clash of systems, a clash of memes. In the Western world, there's just no context for divine madness and the deconstruction crisis that come with it. Hence, layers of difficulties upon layers of difficulties when trying to bring a genuine guru to the West, especially if it's not a timid and pale guru, but a spiritual genius that can unfold the full punch of the tradition. We'll finish this discussion here, and we'll return to Western methods of teaching in the next talk of this series.